Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Slate's Political Gabfest is sponsored by the University of California, committed to creating solutions to today's environmental challenges. Learn more at universityofcalifornia.edu. The University of California, the power of public. And by PBS, presenting Wolf Hall, the new adaptation of the best-selling book series by Hilary Mantel. Catch this historical drama for a modern audience with Thomas Cromwell at the center of political intrigue in the Tudor court. Wolf Hall airs on Masterpiece on PBS this Sunday, April 5th at 10, 9 central.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for April 3rd, 2015, the So Who Can You Discriminate Against edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura in Washington, D.C. To my right is John Dickerson of Slate and CBS News. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And to my left, but 450 miles away, but on a computer to my left.
That's just how far to your left she is.
Is Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
I saw Emily in her natural habitat of the New York Times Magazine this week.
Oh, really?
We ran into each other.
Yeah, I looked up in the cafeteria and there was David.
Oh, yeah, that's when I got that weird email from you guys saying
that
you'd been meeting without me.
I made David dictate that email because he was having trouble typing it.
Here's the thing. I got an email from you while I was listening to you for last week's show.
That's so funny.
So that was weird. And another thing that's weird is the podcast app that I use to listen to the show allows you to slow the speed down.
So
which I was thinking of suggesting to some whistle stop listeners who say I talk too fast. But when you put you on the slow, it sounds like you are either incredibly high or like drunk and trying to talk to your parents when you've come home and they've caught you. Oh. It's so damn funny. You can't listen to a thing you're saying because it's really funny.
That sounds perfect.
So if you're looking for giggles, just listen to us at 0.5 speed and it'll, I think, perhaps
I feel like I would
you.
Be a subwoofer at 0.5 speed. My voice is already low.
Yours so might just be a constant drone.
On this week's Gabfest, the Iran nuclear deal, which was announced literally seconds before we came into this room. So our processing, we have high processing speed, so we'll be processing that quickly. Then the uproar in Indiana and Arkansas, religious liberty or anti-gay prejudice, we will decide. Then the retirement of Harry Reid and the ascendance of Chuck Schumer. Plus we'll have cocktail chatter. And in Slate Plus, the furor over Trevor Noah should Comedy Central fire him before they've even hired him? And of course, we have a live show at the Bell House next Wednesday night. It is sold out, but we just came up with a great gimmick. So those of you who are coming, why are you looking at me? You already know what the gimmick is.
I'm sorry.
You liked it.
I love the gimmick, but I thought you were... When you went from it's sold out, but we came up with a great gimmick, and I thought it had to do with the sold out part, like people were going to get to sit in drones or something.
You're right. Okay. Sorry about that. Iran deal. John Kerry and Energy Secretary Ernie Moniz, who is my favorite government employee because of his intelligence and his amazing hair, hammered out a deal with their Iranian counterparts. The president announced it. Well, I guess the P5 plus one and the Iranian negotiators announced the deal on Thursday afternoon. The president quickly followed on with his very forceful endorsement of this framework of a deal. And the negotiations, which had gone into double overtime, as everyone was saying, and passed their March 31st deadline, appear to have resulted in the deal that many people like me were hoping for, and many people on the right and in Israel are fearful and very hesitant about. So the deal has a number of elements that we'll run through quickly. It was just announced, so things are in flux. Essentially, Iran will cut by two-thirds the number of centrifuges it's running. It will only run its most basic model centrifuge, about 5,000 to 6,000 of them. Is that right?
6,104.
No, but only 5,000 some will run. They will have that many.
5,060 will enrich uranium for 10 years. Yeah.
This is a sort of a 10 to 15 year deal in most places. There will be a plutonium reactor that they have at the Arak reactor, I think it is. That is, the plutonium reactor will no longer have plutonium to be enriched. There will be vigorous inspection regimen to make sure that Iran is keeping to the terms of the deal so that it's not increasing the number of centrifuges or using material it shouldn't have. Its supply chain will be monitored.
It can only enrich the uranium that it has agreed not to enrich uranium over the 3.67% for at least 15 years. So the key thing, just in terms of thinking about what the big goals of this deal are supposed to be, is basically how fast, if the Supreme Leader woke up one morning and said, I want to go for the bomb, how fast could he do it? And this is basically an effort to build lots of roadblocks in front of him. So the uranium he would have on hand wouldn't be enriched far enough. And the number of centrifuges he would need to spin it up to get it enriched wouldn't be enough of them. And then, according to the president, this will be the most robust inspections regime for any country in the world. And so the minute he started trying to enrich, he would presumably be caught.
And then the sanctions would snap back into place. That's
there's a lot of snap back into place.
But the sanctions are going to be lifted. And what I was not clear from, and maybe you guys in my quick listening and quick reading, how are the sanctions getting lifted? How fast are they getting lifted? When do they get lifted?
My understanding, and again, as David pointed out, we're all just kind of figuring this out as we go along, is that the IAEA will do a kind of preliminary inspection. And if they certify that the preliminary terms of the deal have been met by Iran, then the sanctions will be lifted. So
it's a little fuzzy as yet, and those are some of the details they're supposed to work out by June 30th.
Right.
Well, that's
different.
And
that's why it's not quite clear.
Yeah, no. well, that's different. Is that that's a separate big problem, which is that this deal they've announced isn't really a deal. I mean, it's a framework for a deal that they then have to put in super specific language, and in the details, that's where it will get very, very complex and where everybody will be looking, because that's where you could change some of these big top line numbers we're hearing. And also this one facility that was a secret facility, I think it's the Fordow facility, that Iran used to say didn't even exist, but then through spying, the rest of the world discovered. They say, well, it'll now be a peaceful nuclear facility. Well, what exactly does that mean, and who gets to determine that? And that'll all be worked out in what has to be done by June 30th. Then after June 30th, the IAEA will make its determination. If they give Iran a clean bill of health, then the sanctions would be lifted. And now that's if the U.S. Congress votes to lift the sanctions, and then also if the U.N., I think, has to decide to lift their sanctions.
But the U.S. Congress will not vote to lift the sanctions, presumably. So the president will suspend the sanctions autonomously, right?
I don't think the president has conceded all of that yet.
He can lift some, but I don't think he can lift the whole ball. I think he needs their help.
But there is no chance.
I don't. Well, that's that we should get.
Yeah, but they're not in that stance yet. I mean, the president, when he was speaking today, was forcefully imploring Congress to go along with this deal and lift the sanctions if all of the checks, all of the check boxes get checked that John just laid out.
Right, but is there any political, is there any chance that this Congress, 2 years before an election, a presidential election, is going to vote to endorse President Obama's Iran strategy and lift the sanctions on Iran, the country that is perceived to be the greatest enemy to the United States of any country in the world, I think.
It seems like the answer is no, but why is that? Is it because Iran is perceived to be the enemy, or is it because the Republicans and Israel's Bibi Netanyahu have dug themselves in opposition so far that they're not going to be able to climb out no matter what the terms of this deal are?
Well, I think Israel, you rightly put the focus on Israel. I mean, it depends what the reaction from Israel is about this deal, and that'll determine.
I mean, it will be negative. Like, I feel like if, you know, no matter what this deal says in it, Netanyahu has to slam it at this point.
Right. And they've already made a statement. The Israelis made a statement which basically said, while you're appeasing the Iranians are sponsoring terror throughout the region and the world.
Right.
And
right.
So
I mean, there's
no
chance way.
They're going to be.
Yeah, he can't back down. And so I feel like the answer to your question about Congress is not actually about the kind of towering evil of Iran in the world. Not that its leadership is good. It's not. But it just feels like we're not talking about actual rational reactions necessarily, which is part of what the president was trying to warn against in his speech on Thursday.
And he also on Thursday set up a pretty stark kind of view of things that's going to irritate not only the Israelis, but also Republicans and even probably maybe some Democrats who are friends of Israel. The president basically said there were three options: do a deal of the kind that they think they're moving towards, have a war, or have a war. I mean, the third option was break off the negotiations, which would inexorably lead to a war. So
right. It's
not usually been the case when he says it's either my way or a third war in the Middle East that people not predisposed to believing him suddenly snap into agreement with him. And they usually go the other way. So that's likely to.
Look, I am a huge fan of the fact they've made this deal. I think it's probably
I am Iran's best friend.
But it is false to say there isn't a war. There is a war. The question is there a war in which we are an active party? There is a war going on between generally Shiite-aligned forces in this region and generally Sunni-aligned forces with the extremists are pushing it in both directions. And it's a huge, you know, struggle. It's a struggle at one level among trying to suppress fundamentalist forces of various stripes. It's also a power struggle for the kind of Shiite bloc led by Iran, but also encompassing some of Syria, Iraq, some parts of Lebanon, against a Sunni bloc, which is led by Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Pakistan, and which wants to continue its general regional power there. So to say there isn't going to be a war is not quite right. There already is a war.
So what the president
was, but we're talking about different kinds of wars.
Yeah,
different,
exactly. Yeah. Right. What he was talking about is a war to stop them from getting a nuclear weapon.
Right. But I think we should. Right. But
which
I don't
would
think
be a big, ugly, not the proxy war and continuous skirmishing struggle you're talking about. We're talking about big, open, send all the missiles, send all the men and women, let's all go die.
Right. But I don't think we should. I don't think this has much to do with general peace in that region. I think this has to do with a specific problem around Iran's nuclear ambitions and Iran's economic sanctions. It doesn't really have to do with the overall regional battle for power. And one of the interesting questions, and President Obama already talked about this, that he had already talked to the king of Saudi Arabia, but that how the Sunni governments of that region react to this.
Right.
Is there going to be a Saudi? Does this make the Saudis more likely to be aggressive towards Iran, more likely to have a nuclear program, the Turks more likely to have a nuclear program, or less?
Right. You've got at least three audiences. There's the Congress, Israel, and then Saudi Arabia and others that if they don't buy that this is a real deal, then they'll continue their nuclear weapons programs. And Israel not only will influence U.S. lawmakers, but I mean, there are some people who worry that Israel, assuming from this deal that the U.S. no longer has its back, will go its own way militarily with Iran. So, yeah, those are all.
And then don't we also have to think about whether this deal will entrench and empower the Iranian leadership, which we would like to see fall because we want to share David's idealized view of how the Iranian people really want different, better, moderate, unfundamentalist
but
leaders?
Iran is a complicated country. It has a leadership. It has a sort of top layer of leadership, which ultimately runs the country, which is theocratic and very dangerous and bad. But it also has a democratically elected government, which has significant actual power and has actual power over the economy and actual power over foreign policy, which is a kind of government that we ought to want to work with. The government of Rouhani is a government that is, it's not an irrational actor. It's not like, they're not crazy pants. These are people who we can work with.
Yeah, but the theocrats, like you said, are at the top. And we can't just like pretend they're not there.
Yeah, but I actually think that you have to you have to separate a government like Iran from one like Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, the theocratic structure and the governmental structure are completely contiguous. They are one thing. In Iran, they're actually – the governmental structure and theocratic structure are different, and they have different influences. And while it's true that the theocratic structure has ultimate authority over the governmental structure, it is not true that it's exercised at every single minute or that these
– But effectively.
No, it's not effectively.
But like, where's the line? Where's the difference?
We don't know. And our job is to kind of try to cultivate and
but
encourage.
But is it better to hope or better to assume that – what we've basically believed, which is that the theocratic structure has control over the governing direction of the country, specifically when it comes to national security issues. Is it better to hope
and
it's not the case?
And then do we have to worry about a deal that makes them more powerful within the country?
I don't even get the point you're making, John.
Well, I guess even the most dovish people on our relationship with Iran don't think that the theocratic rulers like don't have control over the relevant issues in the context of this national security
conversation. But there's a difference between—they're not figureheads, but nor are they in control of every
They don't collect parking. That's true.
These negotiations were hammered out by people who were elected by a relatively more moderate part of the population. And the nuclear negotiator is a did you guys read the profile of Ernie Moniz and the Iranian nuclear negotiator? It was a great story about the two of them, which they both.
MIT buddies.
MIT.
Or at least
they weren't buddies, but they had similar paths in MIT. Brilliant nuclear scientists. And they are able to have a discussion at a kind of technical, intellectual level that was super important and actually useful and practical, and was not something that had you sent a kind of religious hack who doesn't know anything about the science, they couldn't have had that conversation. They couldn't have gotten to the practical conclusions that they seem to have reached. And so I just think it's a mistake to monolithically say Iran is Ayatollah Khamenei and it is not the Rouhani government and the kind of intellectual class of people who represent a more moderate and represent more popular will of the country because they are
both
exist.
But isn't there a more nuanced set of questions? Okay, so let's say everything you're saying is true, although I think it's
probably
a little bit
shaded. Because I am true.
Because you are your own version of a supreme leader. Still, one wonders how this deal will play for the power of the theocrats because they're not – you can't just like pretend that they are not relevant to the discussion. They are.
Right. I'm not pretending.
So if Rouhani's government gets some credit for this, will the supreme leader – may have a beer just like yours, also get credit? Or and will that – how is that going to play out in the larger Shia-Sunni conflict?
Well, frankly, if the moderating forces, moderate the government of Iran and moderate the country and allow it to rejoin the community of nations and the Khamenei gets to be the ruler of that, that seems okay to me.
I don't know why you're so sanguine about
him. I'm not sanguine. I'm just like
– He's a bad guy.
What does that mean to say he's a bad guy? It means that they pursue
a set – I think it means that they spend a lot of their money on organizations that try to kill other people.
Yeah,
I think
he
is
sponsoring
terrorism. That's not good.
They're
like one of the global sponsors of terrorism, which exists to like go kill other people, many of whom are Jews.
They are a global sponsor of activities that they believe advance their national interests, and they do it across borders, and they do it with people in other countries. And
lots
they're pursuing
of
their national,
die.
But
and
some of those pursuits are bad, and some of them aren't bad, as is true with almost every country that has a foreign policy. Like that is true of Russia. It is true of China. It is true of the United States. It's true of most countries in the world that have an active military or expanded military,
we have,
are doing,
we have
are
broken
doing
the
like
bonds that. Into the vast reach of relativism. Like, all countries the same. Ah, whatever. Your narrative is your narrative.
Seriously.
Our narrative is our narrative. Let's.
I find the kind of demonization, that it, demonization appears to me to be like the absolute least useful way of looking at countries that is possible. And so why not try to look at Iran and its, how Iran pursues its national interests in the way that you would look at any other country pursuing
its national interests. Right. So I think people would say if they're pursuing their national interest and in the furtherance of that national interest, they spend a lot of money trying to kill people. It's not crazy thinking that if they got an ultimate weapon, they might put that ultimate weapon towards the purpose of killing other people, which they've otherwise been pretty engaged in for a pretty long period of time. So strictly on a realpolitik national interest, following their history and pattern and example, it's not crazy to think, at least as a negotiating proposition, that they might behave in the future the way they behaved in the past.
But John, how is Iran's going forth and killing lots of people notably different from, say, Turkey's going forward and killing Kurds that it perceives to be endangering its national interest, from Israel going forth and killing Palestinians that it perceives to be against its national interest?
The issue here is how to approach the Iranians, not like...
I know, but we are able to...
They're the ones whose nuclear capability is on the table right now.
Pakistan.
Not the Turks.
India, Russia, China. Those are nuclear powers. Israel, nuclear powers that do not always act in ways that we believe to be savory.
And all of which is why they don't want the Iranians to get a nuclear weapon. Because the Pakistani example is a perfect one.
Yeah, I was just thinking
about
that.
Like, we trusted them. They're emerging. They're doing okay. They're doing, you know, they're moving towards Western view. Whoop, nope. Now they've got a bomb.
That wasn't, Pakistan snuck its weapon. It didn't, that,
right,
it didn't get
because,
it. Right,
but because people because weren't
we
being vigilant.
Away, or at least partly.
And Pakistan's
look,
a very...
I mean, I do sympathize. I do feel like there is always something very strange about the United States, the whole P5+1 team saying, you can't have the bomb, we have it, but you can't have it. There is something, like, fundamentally strange about that. However, in terms of the world being a safer place, which was the goal that Obama kept trying to reinforce on Thursday, you do want to think about Iran in a multifaceted way, I think. And I feel like your way of thinking about it is... I get that demonization isn't useful, but I also feel like pretending that they're, you know, just like everybody else is also not quite right.
I guess I don't think that that's what I'm doing. I guess I think that I'm actually the multifaceted one and you guys are simplistic. But we can stop it there. The point I want to hit, the last final point.
I hope you're right, by the way.
The last point I want to touch on before we wrap this this negotiation session up is how satisfying was it to have, going back to Ernie Moniz and John Kerry, this kind of two-man frickin' frack negotiation team in Lausanne with the Iranians, to have something actually get hammered out,
yes,
like through people just sort of sitting in a room, banging on each other, yeah, negotiating part personal relationship, part strategy, part like playing to a crowd, playing to the globe. Like, how great was that?
Right. No, it's true. And because we've become conditioned in both Washington and also with the Israeli-Palestinian talks to people staying up all night and then nothing happening. It's just totally collapsing. So it was a surprise to kind of think about, like, oh, hey, who knows if it'll work out? Who knows if it's good, bad? But, like, at least we've become so shriveled in our expectations here in Washington.
It's
and, like,
true.
Any kind of a damn result is amazing. So I agree with you.
Don't you like John Kerry 10 times more than usual today? I just feel like he finally found his role and has become far less irritating in the process.
Can I, before we reach escape capacity on this or breakout capacity on this issue, two things.
1 year. This topic will go
one
on
year.
For exactly 1 year.
For 15 months. I've got two other things I want to add to the end. One is it'll be interesting to watch the race among Republican presidential candidates to lay down their markers. It tells us a couple of things. How fast can you lay down a marker before you know what the hell's in the actual deal? We've all said multiple times.
Surely Ted Cruz has already denounced it.
Right. We've said multiple times on this show, we're not exactly sure what's in the deal. Our notions are provisional, but we're not running for president. When we'll see how fast candidates speak about something that they can't possibly know about is the first. And secondly, will the threshold question be, when you become president, will you undo this deal? Will you work to replace it with sanctions? And just, it'll be interesting to find out what that level is. And then finally, in terms of elections mattering and what candidates say in elections. Think back to Obama and his fight with Hillary Clinton in 2008, where one of the debates in the primaries was about whether he would meet and negotiate with Iran with no preconditions about a nuclear weapon. And this is the culmination.
That was very naive.
The
right?
other thing
that was portrayed as very naive.
That's exactly right. That was portrayed as naive. And the other thing he said in the debates about foreign policy was that he would go into Pakistan if he found out that. Did he say that if he found out bin Laden, or did he say if they had a weapon? I can't remember which. But he said he would basically trample on Pakistan's sovereignty
well,
if U.S. national. And so he did that. So here are two items from debates, which are not always seen as the great illuminators of national policy. Two items from the debates that actually came and turned out to be true as
Plus,
they played
Mitt
out.
Romney was kind of right about Russia.
Right. So that means more debates. Everybody pay lots of attention to the debates. So and then finally, the question for history is this a riskier move for Obama than his decision to kill bin Laden?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, much.
Okay.
Yeah. The GabFest is brought to you today by the University of California, committed to creating solutions to today's environmental challenges. Researchers at the University of California are working to lessen the dire effects of drought. Goodness, we learned a lot about that this week. By developing new varieties of crops that require less water to thrive. Learn more at universityofcalifornia.edu. The University of California, the power of public. And now for today's featured research. Who knew coffee could grow in California? Not I. Traditionally, coffee is an equatorial crop, thriving not in Mediterranean climates like California, but in tropical countries like Brazil, Ethiopia, and Indonesia. Yet efforts by Southern California farmers to grow the beans have been brewing for a while, and the resulting caffeinated cups are meeting with critical and consumer acclaim. Is Golden State Joe the next wave in coffee consumption? The University of California's Division of Agriculture and Natural Resources believes it is. To read this story and uncover more groundbreaking research from the University of California, visit slate.com/breakthroughs. In solidarity, we've canceled our planned GabFests in Indianapolis and Little Rock. We canceled GabFests that were not going to happen.
We have had
Indianapolis and Little Rock. We have had several
multiple GabFests in Indiana. I mean, I'm trying to think of another.
Hey, they're fixing their bill now. We should
go
we
back.
Should congratulate them and show up.
Other than New York and Washington, is there another city? And other than West Lafayette, is the third most frequented GabFest city?
Is that
right?
True?
Right. Yeah, we've done two shows there.
We did two Chicago, two San Francisco.
Oh, we did two.
Let
Chicago.
Let it be known, we did not tell anyone they could not
but
attend
right.
the show.
San Francisco, you know, as everyone knows, the great threesome: San Francisco, Chicago, and West Lafayette, Indiana.
So it's hard to keep up with this. There's so many fast-moving stories this week. This is the other one. Arkansas and Indiana's legislatures, of course, have each passed expansive religious freedom laws that critics say would give shelter to businesses seeking to discriminate against gay customers and maybe others. The Indiana bill was signed into law by Governor Mike Pence, who is now kind of frantically backpedaling in the wake of a national fury about the law from both progressives and from big corporations. And Indiana appears to be about to modify its law. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, who initially said he was going to sign this bill, has now said he will not sign a bill that was passed by the legislature without it being seriously revised. So,
in part because of Walmart, of all companies.
Well, yeah, Walmart. Yeah, so we'll talk about why it is, why that is, of all companies.
Yeah.
So is the wave that arose against these laws, is this just sort of smug coastal elite moralism, or is it a righteous political crusade, Emily?
It's pretty righteous. I mean, it's a little bit random in a way that I don't feel like I completely understand as someone who's been watching religious freedom restoration acts and the politics of them for a long time. But I find this so satisfying, primarily because this turned into a super close reading of the text of this law. And essentially, two things torpedoed it. One was that some clever law professors or legislators wrote into the law that it would apply in circumstances where there was a dispute between private parties. The government didn't have to be there. So most religious freedom restoration acts, certainly the federal one, say basically that the government isn't supposed to substantially burden someone's free exercise of religion unless the government has a really good reason and does it in the least restrictive means possible. And so the kind of standard lawsuit under one of these statutes is like the prison one before the Supreme Court this year, although that's actually a different law, but it's related, where there was a prisoner with a short beard. He said that was his expression of Muslim faith. The prison didn't have a good reason for telling him to cut his 1.5-inch long beard, so we got to keep it. But Indiana wanted this law to protect businesses that don't want to provide services for gay weddings. And the sort of case that was out there that the Indiana drafters were responding to is called Elaine Photography. It's from New Mexico. And it was a photography studio that didn't want to shoot a gay wedding. They were sued. And the New Mexico Supreme Court said, our state Religious Freedom Act doesn't apply here because this is a dispute between a business and an individual. New Mexico also has a broad anti-discrimination law that protects gay people. So that is different. Indiana doesn't. But in any case, there was this desire to protect businesses like that photography studio. And then everyone actually noticed that that had been added to the law, and it created a lot of rage against the law. And it also made Governor Pence look like he didn't understand the statute, or he was lying about it, because he kept saying it was just the same as all the other ones. And then the other thing that messed up this law is Hobby Lobby, because the Supreme Court's decision in Hobby Lobby, which is also, it's about the federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, said that all of a sudden big businesses counted as having religious rights, this kind of crazy idea. And so that also created much more breadth to Indiana's statute, to all the statutes than existed before. And people noticed. So it was like this, usually all of this happens in this kind of legalistic way that, you know, it feels like it doesn't really hit the public consciousness. And somehow it penetrated this time.
John, so there was the way these laws were passed, and then there was this backlash which sort of moved from left and gay activists very quickly to corporations saying, you know, boycotts, et cetera. But there were some Republican presidential candidates who kind of jumped in to support Mike Pence almost instantly and stood with these laws. Do you think this is going to be an issue that they are going to continue to stick with? You've already seen Jeb Bush sort of back away from his stance on it. Are they going to move away from it?
Well, I think it's some of the presidential candidates. Well, okay, hold on. Let's step back. If you look at the Republican coalition, blue-collar, older white voters, that coalition tends to be the one that feels where there's the least support for same-sex marriage. But this is more than about same-sex marriage. The religious liberty piece of this goes to the evangelical wing of the conservative movement that cares just about being able to worship and see the traditional, what they see as the traditional values of American culture maintained and not destroyed by either the state or by just the advance of the sort of heathen culture. But there's also a sort of government intrusion, cultural intrusion on values that go beyond religion. So this gets at like a lot of the anger in or upset and concern in conservative circles. What you often hear when you talk to voters when they say, you know, I want the country back that I grew up in. So there's a lot here that's big and roiling, and Republican candidates do not want to get on the other side of that in a primary context. Now, add that initial instinct to stick with the voters that are going to be voting in the primaries to what Emily discussed, which is most of them, and Jeb Bush was a little flip or a little snide in his first remark, which was, well, if you read the statute, you'd understand it's like the federal one. So he was sort of saying, you know, well, I'm, you know, if you weren't such a big dummy and you had done your homework like I had, you would know. That was his first remark. And then he said, but he still sort of defended, as you said, David, he defended Pence and kind of told people to just kind of calm down a little bit. And it was smart of him. He was the first one to do it. And he's got the most people in that portion of the party who are skeptical of him. Now, as you say, he's reversing and saying Indiana's going to, the governor's going to get to the right position, which, if the law was fine in the first place, as Bush had said, he would have no cause to get to the right position. So anyway, he's all over the place. Christie is sort of in the Bush position. I think this shows the tension, and Ron Brownstein has a great piece on this in National Journal, the tension in the Republican Party between the coalition that's going to vote in the primaries, which is this blue-collar, older evangelical coalition, and the coalition that is growing in the general, which is millennials. In Asa Hutchinson in Arkansas, it was Walmart that was banging on him because for them and in Indiana, it's just a commercial proposition. I mean, people were canceling trips to Indiana. Angie's List was canceling, I guess, doing business in Indiana. The NC2As was thinking about it.
The NCAA was making noise.
So, you know, once the Chamber of Commerce is against you, you have to move. But also, Asa Hutchinson said in his public remarks, he said his son had signed a petition against him, his father, the governor, signing it, which is there's a huge break in the Republican Party between those under 30, those over in terms of same-sex marriage.
His son is not a Republican.
Who, Asa's?
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, I didn't know that. But Eve Witt Ayers, who's the pollster for Marco Rubio, said nobody under 30 is going to stick with you as a Republican Party if you're seen as against these issues. So if you look at the larger electorate in the general, those under 30, college-educated women, suburban women, those are people that Republicans are going to need to reach out to, and they won't if this becomes a defining thing for the party.
But how do we? We all know, it's very clear now, like where we're going to be on marriage equality and 50 years. How, as a society and through our laws, how do we acknowledge and give people time to change?
Yeah.
Not everyone moves as fast as you do.
That's a fantastic question.
So what do we do? How does the law account for it?
Here's where I come down on this, and I really have been wrestling with it all week. I'm not sure this is the right answer, but let me try it out. So it seems like the reason for opposing new laws like this is the context in which they're passing and the way in which they are a kind of loaded weapon allowing for discrimination, refusal to serve gay couples, that is not in sync with the direction of equality and also can have some serious ramifications. I mean, the supporters of these laws always want to talk about the little old lady baking wedding cakes, but what about adoption agencies and landlords? Like, there are real things at stake here. I feel like those are all really good reasons for opposing this version of a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I'm not sure, though, that I think every gay couple denied service has to go sue. In other words, on a personal level, you know, so, for example, there's one pizzeria in Indiana where the owners went on TV and they said, look, like this is our religious belief. And they are now just being pilloried online. That the inevitable pileup that happens, like people are trying to slam them on Yelp and like now they're standing for religious bigotry. I just feel like really like this is they're not the source of evil in the world. And I would rather have a sort of turn the other cheek attitude toward these small businesses, not one that means that we have to legally protect them, that just means that on an individual level, people would decide not to go after them. It's not really like a legal answer. It's just a social one.
A little restraint is what you're
talking
about. That's what
restraint.
You're bringing to me. Now, what's interesting about the pizza, I wanted to bring this up because David mentioned the fast moving and fast pace of things. If you watch this story, first of all, back to our previous point about legislation happening and getting fixed quickly. Like, we've never seen such a thing in Washington.
Oh,
where
my
there's
God,
like
it's
a,
amazing.
Yeah. But in part, that's because of the speed of social media and the speed and power of things like, in this case, it's traditional power leverage when a company decides not to go to Indiana. So that's not, that doesn't
have anything
to do with
social
media.
But it's like the combination, right, of the threats from the businesses plus the social media wildfire.
Right. And that wildfire, to pick up on your point, Emily, killed that poor pizzeria because, okay, so the pizzeria is an openly Christian. They have
crosses
on the walls. And so what happens is a local news station goes like, finds the one Christian place, puts the microphone in front of the woman's, you know, face and says, they ask her about the law. And she says, well, because of my belief. So it's not like she, like the owner of the store, took a big stand on this. She was there.
No, they
asked
like
the
went
question.
In and found
right.
The right. Exactly.
And now for she her. Becomes the like most hated person, you know, for the moment in the rage machine on the internet. And then there is it moves to Yelp. This debate moves from social media to Yelp. And now there's a GoFund effort because the pizzeria, I think, has now closed forever. There's now a GoFund effort to give them money, which is raised by Thursday afternoon $187,000. So we've moved now Yelp to GoFund, which is
the backlash against the backlash.
So it's like the backlash against the backlash against the backlash, which moves from social media outlet to social media outlet as it, you know, or not outlet, but whatever you want to call GoFund and Yelp. And that's all in like such a short period of time.
Right. I think there's an interesting historic analogy, which I think I'm not sure what it tells us, but one of the things that happened in the civil rights movement, as we learned, you know, if you saw Selma, is you have these legal changes that occur, and there are clearly social changes that are occurring, but there's government resistance and social resistance, so that the civil rights movement moves so slowly. I mean, school, if you look at the story of school integration, you have Brown v. Board in 54.
Yeah, all deliberate speed turned out to mean like sort of never.
Yeah,
or
it became massive
really,
resistance.
Really, and so, took a long time.
And so you can imagine if you're a civil rights activist concerned with marriage equality now, you would say, I'm going to be skeptical when states and the law and large entities are standing against marriage equality, because the history of this, the recent history of this in the United States, is they can really slow things down and stop the progress and make things slower than they should be. So you have to balance the ability to give people space to grow and change and develop new views with the need to actually cause those changes to take place too. So it's not like it's
totally yeah it's not to, you don't want to slow walk progress.
Yeah, but mostly this social change has taken place with just amazing rapidity, and I feel like what I keep hearing in the remarks by some religious conservatives on this topic is like, but this isn't discrimination. And there's a way in which I think their framing is, well, I just don't want to participate in this gay wedding. To me, marriage is a Christian sacrament. This goes against my belief. I just want to stay out of it. And, you know, I think they're wrong that refusing to serve customers isn't a form of discrimination. It is. But you can see a way in which, like, there's just this gap in conceptualizing the issue, and I imagine people on the other side of this must just feel like, wait a second, this was what everyone thought like yesterday. How did this change so fast?
But I want to get to, I want to interrogate this question of when is it okay to refuse to serve customers, because I was thinking about this. So you would agree, if a customer, you own a gun store and a customer comes to you and says, I'm going to buy this gun so I can murder my wife, you'd be like, I'm not going to sell you the gun, I'm sorry, if they literally told you that.
Yeah, and that's not like they're a protected category.
No, that's not a protected category. But then, you know, Nazi guy comes to your cake shop. Everyone's got a cake shop.
But believe me, the thing about Nazi guys is that they're mad for cakes.
They want swastikas on every birthday.
They want a swastika on their cake. Are you not entitled to not make the swastika?
You are entitled to say no, legally speaking, because being a Nazi is not a category that we protect against discrimination. It's not race, religion, ethnicity, and now we are gradually adding sexual orientation to that list.
Well, but
being
what
a Nazi,
you know, my,
not on the list.
My Scientology cake. I want my Scientology cake.
Well, then we get into whether Scientology is a religion or not. If the state recognizes it as a religion, that counts.
When can you... If you have a business, when can you not serve people?
Whenever they don't have shirts or shoes on. No, seriously, you cannot serve them whenever you're
That's
your
the problem
reason...
with all the gay people getting married. They just don't. They're not wearing shirts.
That's not true. Whenever your reason for not serving them is not about discriminating against them on the basis of a facet of identity that we have decided as a society is a form of discrimination we don't want to endorse. And we have a list, and gradually, happily, sexual orientation is
but
on
it's
that
not,
list.
But it's not on the list in Indiana.
Well,
right?
It's on the list in parts of the country and not others. It's on the list in Indianapolis and South Bend and Bloomington, but not the rest of Indiana.
Right. So why can't you? If you're
Well, in fact, you can. I mean, that is this weird irony underneath the fight over this law and the sort of singling out of Indiana as opposed to a bunch of other states where this is also true. Not to mention, we don't have a federal anti-discrimination law that protects against discrimination broadly on the basis of sexual orientation. So the truth is that in Indiana, gay people are not protected if someone wants to fire them because they're gay. And that's not going to change even after they fix this law. And so what, it's funny, I feel like one of the things we have learned from the backlash against Indiana's law is that lots of people kind of assume that, of course, it's not okay to fire someone because they're gay. And maybe we sort of forgot to actually enact the legislation around the country that would provide for that. But it's sort of, we've sort of arrived at that point socially before we did legally. Right. And maybe the next thing this wave of activism should accomplish is actually backing for those bills, one of which is on the table in North Dakota right
but
now.
But ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, passed the Senate, right?
Yeah, but it only applies in certain circumstances, right? It's not the kind of broad anti-discrimination provision that, yeah.
So I think two things we can expect is, one, another outbreak along these lines before we get to the end of our election season, if for no other reason than it is now in the it now advantages Democrats in a way that it used to advantage Republicans
right.
for many, many, many years to keep these events in the news and to sometimes perhaps even keep them in the news when the merits of the case don't necessarily suggest that it should be. So that'll be interesting to see if that happens a lot in our, you know, between now and the election.
The Gaffes is sponsored by PBS presenting Wolf Hall. Sunday,
oh, my
April 5th.
God, I can't wait.
Oh, that's 10, the best ever sponsor.
Central
we're all down
on
for
Masterpiece.
That one.
We are literally dressed as they would be in the 15th century.
Yeah.
Right, 15th
we
century?
Wish we were.
I saw that they said sponsor. I saw that yesterday. I saw that we had the sponsorship. I went home and put this on my DVR. Wolf Hall.
What's the date? April.
April 5th. Sunday, April 5th. Wolf Hall is based on the best-selling book series by Hilary Mantel about political intrigue at the Tudor court. This historical drama for a modern audience revolves around Thomas Cromwell, the enigmatic and brilliant power broker who served Henry VIII. It stars Mark Rylance as Cromwell, Damian Lewis as Henry VIII, and Claire Foy as Anne Boleyn. Wolf Hall airs on Masterpiece on PBS Sunday, April 5th, 10 Eastern, 9 Central. Definitely not missing that. That's going to be so great. It is, if you haven't read that book, read it. And it's excellently visual, too, so I bet it'll be fantastic as a series.
What I wished I had had with that book and what I tried to create on my own and failed miserably was just like a, was it something to help, like with Game of Thrones, something to help me. Who are all these characters right. and where's the dates and how is this timeline working? And
but
like,
you could just go and read the real history, like Wikipedia, Thomas
but
Cromwell.
But then you find out what happens to him.
Yeah, but
like,
then,
oh,
but right, I want it in the right, I don't want a spoiler special. I mean, it did happen 600 years ago, but still, I want, or 500 years ago, but I
what,
want,
wait,
you know.
What was Anne Boleyn's fate? What did
yeah,
happen
no,
to
well,
her?
Yeah, no, well, the Anne Boleyn, like, I got that, but it's, I don't know, I just felt like I needed a little companion.
I know
a little
exactly
reader's
what you
guide,
mean.
A little laminated.
I think a lot of people felt that. Also, that book had a serious like proper noun pronoun problem.
Oh,
was
that
really
was
hard
so
to tell.
Great!
It was so.
Oh
hard.
My God, that's what
she
amazing
fixed it in
about
the second one, though. Don't you think? I felt like the what's it called? Bring up the bodies. I think it was better.
I thought that I so disagree with you. That part of the understanding who is speaking and how is so alienating. And thus causes you to make do so much work, and it makes the book so much richer.
It's like when I first read The Sound and the Fury, you're like, wait, who's thinking? Whose
right.
head am I in?
Right.
Proving once again that you're better readers than I am. I wanted a little more help along the way.
No, I'm not a better reader. I thought it was a book about race car driving and kung fu fights. I got no idea what this book's about.
All right, let's go to we should just do that as a topic, man. Wolf Hall, wow. Anyway, PBS, you got your money's worth for that, PBS. We are... Every GabFest listener, go watch that show. Okay, third topic, Harry Reid, 75-year-old Senate Minority Leader, Democrat from Nevada, will not, or am I pronouncing it right? I can never remember.
Nevada.
Whenever I say the state, someone criticizes me. Nevada won't run for re-election. He would have faced a very tough battle. He thought that the Republican establishment and fundraisers would spend a huge amount to try to defeat him. Probably they would have. And he, you know, he's had some health problems and he just wanted out.
And he's a very bad candidate.
So oops, Chuck Schumer too. Of New York State will probably replace him in 2017 as a Democrat Senate leader. Reid is going out. He's taking credit for the stimulus, for Obamacare, for a lot of judicial appointments, for having pushed Obama to run for president to begin with, I think. So let's just talk briefly about Reid. Does he deserve credit for these various achievements of the Obama presidency?
I think he really deserves credit. Well, credit's the wrong word. He is most directly responsible for the judicial appointments, ending the threshold on filibuster, lowering the threshold on filibusters for judicial appointments, which then led to a lot of people getting through and getting you know, their nominations being approved. And so that is the thing over which he had the most control, exercised that control, and changed Senate tradition in a way that was like a big deal. All this other stuff, the role is less direct. And I think when you want to think about his legacy, I mean, he did warp and pervert the Senate and the ability of senators, even from his own party, to get amendments onto bills in a way that was really, and you hear Democrats complaining about it all the time, that was breathtaking. That is a part of and contributed to the sclerosis of the Senate. And so I think he's got, you know, marks against him as well as, I think he's got those marks against him.
It's sort of a weird double-edged sword kind of legacy, right? Where lowering the threshold for the filibuster, which I really promise myself to continue to support even when it means that a lot of really conservative judges get appointed, that made the Senate a more democratic body, right? It meant that there were fewer instances in which, you know, a smaller number of senators, mostly from small states, could prevent stuff from happening. And yet, the second attribute you were just talking about, his incredibly controlling attitude toward bills, made the Senate more autocratic.
Yeah, and I guess I would say one other thing we should add to this was his extraordinary response when asked about, remember he went on the floor of the Senate and said basically Mitt Romney wasn't releasing his tax returns because he hadn't paid them.
Yeah, and that was wrong.
Totally wrong. Like, asked about it recently, he was like, his answer was, well, he didn't win, did he? Which was really appalling. That's you know, I mean, he was nobody ever said he was a choir boy. In fact, one of the fascinating things about him is just how tough and relentlessly tough he was. And I love this anecdote that he ran 20 marathons, and because marathons themselves weren't, I guess, challenging enough to that sense of like constant grinding progress, he tried to run at least one of them without taking any water.
Yeah.
And I also like that at one point, when he was gambling commissioner in Nevada, was it one of the mob guys who was trying to bribe him? He put him in a chokehold.
Yeah,
he's a tough
and
mother.
And he punched his father-in-law.
Yeah.
Got into a fistfight with him. That's another good one.
Yeah.
Why? So the Senate is filled with people who love to talk, with your John Kerry types, your Lindsey Graham types.
Your Chuck Schumer types.
In Reid and in McConnell, you have two super grinders, guys who don't have any obvious charisma, but who've made it. Why did they make it? I guess they're willing to do the dirty work. Is that why?
It's a really good question. I think they're different people. So the Reid story is that he really took care of his members, that he had the patience and diligence and focus to take care of what his members needed. And so when Daschle fell, Reid was there, much the same way this is happening with Schumer. When Daschle fell and was defeated by John Thune, Reid was ready to call people and say, not like, oh, hey, I'll do this for you in the future. It's, you know, I have been there for you. And then he just maintained that. And that was true, apparently, especially among the female senators. And I think Schumer, having been the chairman of the DS, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, in a successful year, also has those kinds of relationships and can deliver in that kind of way.
Is it bad for the Democrats that Schumer is perceived as being in the pocket of Wall Street?
I think it's good for Democrats and a party when your majority leader, or minority leader in this case, is in a pretty unassailable seat, because one of the reasons, Reid barely won last time to a candidate.
Right.
Republicans will tell you now are crazy. And, you know, Mitch McConnell ended up having a pretty easy race, but he didn't in his primary. I mean, or he was worried enough in his primary to do so. It'll be interesting to see what and how that changes the dynamic, if they can. And Schumer also is Schumer's interesting because Schumer, like, he wants to make stuff happen. Like, he's almost like what we were saying about the Iraq deal. The Iran deal. It's like sometimes you get the sense that it's like he just wants to make things happen. And just because they're happening, that's progress. So I just wonder if it'll be more active and interesting. He's obviously an incredible partisan, but I think he also kind of likes to get things moving, and that'll be interesting to watch.
Last question on this, John. There was, you know, mutterings and fantasies on the left that this is a moment for Elizabeth Warren to step up into leadership. Was there anything to that?
I think the mutterings and fantasies about the things that Elizabeth Warren can and will do are becoming themselves a thing. I mean, so there's mutterings and fantasies about a
running
for president. She's going to be in Democratic leadership. Right, exactly.
She's releasing an album secretly. She's recorded at midnight.
Exactly. Yes,
she's
right.
She's starring in the next Disney movie.
Yes, she tries.
Peter Pan Live with Elizabeth Warren.
She chalks her pool cue with the dust of unicorn horns. It's, you know, she's got a lot of that surrounds her. No, I don't think that was... Also, by the way, minority leader got to go travel a lot and raise a bunch of money with Wall Street guys. So that doesn't hurt the party and the people running if they have a lot of money flowing in. And you need to be a little less upright about your hatred for big money when you need to raise big money. One other thing I would say, which is kind of extraordinary, well, it would be extraordinary if you took it seriously, was Chuck Schumer, after the last election, said that focusing on passing the Affordable Care Act was a huge political mistake. And he's now the Democratic leader in the Senate, like, which is why I always thought that original thing was a kind of a phony move. Anyway, but
so, but what tell? I was thinking about that and wondering why. I remembered you said it was a phony move, and I don't understand how that plays into this moment. Why was that like a smart thing for him to do strategically?
Because he was trying to make a big noise and sort of present himself as the person who could explain the future, how Democrats should go forward in the future. So he was saying Obamacare fixation bad, should have focused on income inequality, middle class wage stagnation, all these other issues. If he just said that by itself, he would have sounded like every other person on the planet, including Republicans. But if he says this signature achievement of the Obama administration was a mistake, then everybody covers it. And he's seen as this kind of active visionary on behalf of these bedrock democratic principles. So that's not a bad place to be in.
All right. Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you're in Searchlight, Nevada, looking for a drink, looking for Harry Reid and a drink. John Dickerson, what are you going to chatter about?
Well, as we turn to spring, and I'm a bit...
Oh, please, please.
That was Emily turning to spring.
Turning to spring.
Begging.
She's trying to
begging. That's me begging for spring. It's me begging. Spring, please come.
Yeah, and so I'm a bit of a... I think I get this from my mom. I'm a bit... I like the birds in the backyard. So we have a couple of bird feeders, the droll Yankee bird feeders that have the little spinning mechanisms of... squirrels jump on it, they get thrown off. So I like the birds. I'm a fan of the birds. So apparently it has been discovered that the Blackpoll Warbler songbird, which is from New England, which weighs 4.2 ounces, is about the size of a tennis ball, can indeed, and this was apparently a huge like 50-year-long mystery, this bird can fly from New England to South America. That's 1,700 miles without landing. Because it's over water. It's over the Atlantic Ocean. And they basically figured this out by creating tiny little backpacks. I don't know whether they were double strapping or single strapping the backpacks, but the little backpack flight recorders attached to 40 of the birds tracked them as they flew. And they've known for a while that big birds like the albatross could fly long distances, but they could kind of glide. But when you're teeny tiny like that, you have got to be working it to get, you know, and there's nowhere to land. There's no like little post you can hang out on.
How bad would they have felt if like the weight of the backpack had just taken those birds down? They would have concluded, well, the birds can't make it.
It must have been super, super weightless, that backpack.
Totally mass.
It must have weighed like a teeny, 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 tiny
amount. Yeah, mass suicide off the coast of, you know, Carolinas as the poor birds couldn't struggle with the backpack on. Imagine if they didn't have the backpack on, they could, who knows how far they could go.
Exactly.
It'd be like 2,400 miles.
They made it to Rio and they really, really wanted to get down to Patagonia.
That is an awesome question, although I present here for the jury that the backpack is pretty damn small. If that bird is the size of it, no, sure.
But how much
is
the
relative
weight?
Yeah, no, little birds, I don't know. There's a song about little birds, but it's escaping me at the moment.
Three little birds woke up this morning and you smile at the rising sun?
Oh. Good. That's always nice to get David quoting from something. He's got one of those good memories where he can just quote from stuff. I can't
so
even remember.
Enviable.
Anyway, I also didn't know that the albatrosses were known for their ultra long flights because I always think of the albatross as something that is hung around your neck. But if it can fly for a really long distance,
funny.
I'd want it around my neck.
Well,
right?
It meets you in the open ocean.
Oh,
right.
That's how it. Sandpipers and gulls also, by the way, are your long-distance flying birds if you're looking for that kind of thing.
John must be, like, wanting to go on some very exotic long voyage right now.
You just did, so.
I know.
Now chatter.
I am reading a really intriguing book called How to Be Both by Allie Smith. It's a book we're talking about
Hannah's
on the Slate Audio Book Club next month. Did you read it?
No, Hannah's reading it.
I know, because of this book club. And Hannah and I, around the same moment, discovered that there are actually two versions of this book out there in the world. So now I'm thinking about that, along with how I feel about the book. It's written in two halves, and the first half of it I loved, and now I'm part of the way into the second half. So I recommend it. It's interesting, and I'm looking forward to talking about it. How to Be Both by Allie Smith.
All right. I am going to chatter briefly, just about rage, about my rage which is that I now spend half my week up in New York, and part of that involves...
I watched this happen on Twitter. It was quite a sight to behold.
Part of that is,
I felt for you.
It was just unspeakable.
Wait, what happened?
I have to commute. So first from Penn Station to the Atlas Obscura office in Greenpoint. Greenpoint's very hard to get to, those of you who are not from New York. It's a part of New York which is difficult. It's a neighborhood in Brooklyn that's a little bit cut off from everything. And then from Greenpoint out to my in-laws in Queens, which is where I spend my evenings when I'm in New York. The New York subway is just terrible. Everyone from New York is always coming to Washington and making fun of the D.C. subway and talking about how lame it is.
What's wrong with it?
It does not take you
forever. It is constantly delayed. I would say that the trains I take are delayed 3 days out of four. It took me 2 hours to get from Greenpoint to the place in Queens I was trying to go, which I could have walked faster. I could have walked
faster. What were you on, the
faster.
M?
I was on the E. I was on the G and the E. The E train was, it's unspeakable. And I'm sick. You New Yorkers, you're just always lording it over D.C. and telling us how much better your city is. I'm done with that. I'm done with it. It is not true. The D.C. Metro has had lots of problems. We're constantly killing people with it. It is delayed. But there's a fashion of New York delay, which is different and more frustrating and worse than anything I've ever experienced in D.C. by far. So, New Yorkers, you can tell me that I'm wrong, but I won't listen to you. It's infuriating. It's infuriating.
He is right now in a rage.
I mean, listened to an entire podcast between two stations, an entire 23-minute podcast.
Instead of taking the E next time, you should take the F flat.
Mm. Or you should go to Singapore or Hong Kong. Their subways are amazing.
Thanks. Thank you both for this extremely useful advice.
That'll get you to Queens really fast.
Our intern is Tarek Barrett. Our producer is Mike Volo. Our managing producer is Joel Meyer. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcast. The GabFest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Someone was asking me about the Pandemonium Network, the Panda Network. It's Panoply.
How do you spell that?
We no longer have to spell it, John.
I know.
Our show page
is slate.com/gabfest.
It has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. And our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. Email address is gabfest@slate.com. And you can subscribe to the GabFest in iTunes. Leave a comment and rating while you're there, please. It helps us. Who is it? John Dickerson and Emily Bazelon. I'm David Plotz. We'll see you next week in New York. Those of you who are coming to the live show, it's going to be fun.
Don't take the subway. You'll never get there.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets. I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.